This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. If you know anything about Vietnam War-era politics, you know about poet and anti-war activist Allen Ginsberg. From 1968 through 1971, Ginsberg, who was also open about his homosexuality, operated East Hill Farm in rural upstate New York as a retreat for artists in need. Lexington's Gordon Ball was Ginsberg's farm manager and has written a book called East Hill Farm, Seasons with Allen Ginsberg. Ginsberg biographer Bill Morgan says about Gordon's book, Ginsberg hoped to create an Elysium where they could escape from the urban pressures and drug addictions that had laid Jack Kerouac, Gregory Corso, Peter Orlovsky, and Robert Hunke so low. Only a masterful storyteller like Gordon Ball could turn a depressing tale of poets at rock bottom into a triumph of the human spirit.
Well, I woke up this morning, looked out door. I can tell my milk cow, I can tell by the way she lows. If you see my milk cow, please drive her on home. 'Cause I ain't had no milk and butter, woo, since my cow's been gone.
How did you get this gig?
Well, my lady friend in those days, Candy, and I had a friend named Barbara Rubin, who was a young filmmaker who was enamored of Allen and had great hopes for marriage. And towards that end, she was getting him this farm in upstate New York. And the marriage was a pipe dream, but the farm was a reality. I had spent a year in New York. At the end of that, my friend Candy and I conclude that we're tired of city life in the mid-60s New York, and decide to move to Mexico. While in Mexico, living in a tiny village without electricity near the sea and where the jungle and the mountains were too, we were staying there several months and then decided to go deeper into the jungle and went to a larger town one day for supplies, but that was the day the Federales decided to do a big roundup, and so we were put in jail for several weeks and then deported. When we got back to the States, Barbara told us that
Stop. I can't let being in jail in Mexico, being put there by the Federales, just breeze by. What was that experience like?
Well, we were held without charges, though we were interrogated, and they wanted us to say we knew everything about the drug trade, which we didn't. There were about 24 gringos and 10 Mexican presos whom we befriended and shared resources with, and I had a movie camera that was taken from me as everything was surrendered when we entered the jail. But after I was there a few days, I realized that I could ask one guard to hand me that brown bag. And so I began filming and ultimately made a film called Mexican Jail Footage shot inside the jail.
What were the conditions like?
Well, conditions were not bad considering. I mean, we had heard a lot of horror stories and heard more later. We were okay. There wasn't much to eat. You had to send out for food. Conditions were not clean, but it's jail, and we slept on the floor of a courtyard, and we were finally deported. Candy was punched in the stomach by the Federales when she was taken to the plane because she was asked by them in Spanish. Her Spanish was fluent. How she liked Mexico, and she said, "I loved it till I met you guys."
And they punched her.
Right. But we got back okay. So to New York, and Candy greeted me at LaGuardia with the news that Barbara was going to marry Allen and they were getting a farm where we would be caretakers.
Okay. And your response to this?
Well, it sounded good. I mean, after all, we'd gone to Mexico looking for paradise, and now we were going to be together with some of our friends and live in an idyllic situation.
How did you come to call Allen Ginsberg a friend?
I wasn't such a friend at that time. We had met a few times, I think. Pon O'Grady, an art patron, threw a large party at the Dakota where I first met Allen. And I saw him once or twice around town, and we were all together at a New Year's Eve. But we didn't really become friends until Barbara introduced us.
What was your impression of Allen Ginsberg?
Well, I thought he was a special kind of consciousness, if you will, in a day that the country was torn apart by division over the Vietnam War and that young were divided from old, and that here was someone who understood the problems and could speak for the young and sympathize and who valued imagination and curiosity and did things beyond measure for other people.
How would you describe yourself?
Oh, young and
junction.
Young and dreamy.
Yes.
And, young for my years. I mean, I was 23, I think.
Okay. And young for your years,
yes.
In what sense?
Slow to pick up on things, socially inept.
Did you know anything about farming?
No, I didn't know anything about farming. I'd grown up in what was the world's biggest city, Tokyo. But I had the history of my father coming from a large farm in West Virginia. And Peter Orlovsky, Alan's longtime partner, went to an agricultural high school and had some training in agricultural ways.
You arrive up there in this time of year.
Yeah.
What do you find? What do you do?
Well, we find this, of course, unheated house. There was 70 acres, so there was a lot to walk about. There was marshland, and then there was forest, and a good part of it was surrounded by state forest, and that made it quite private and remote. And after all, it was 5 miles anyway from Little Cherry Valley, a hamlet of 800.
Do you remember what you thought when you drove up and saw Home Sweet Home?
No, I just had expectations or hopes. I don't know that I
of what?
Thought. I don't know. Alan was on his way. We'd be spending time with him.
The hopeful band of poets, druggies, and anti-war activists had a good neighbor in the reclusive and very practical Ed Urich, who lived close by in a tar paper shack. As for the band of poets themselves, Peter Orlovsky and his brother Julius figure prominently in Gordon Ball's narrative.
Peter was a victim of his own amphetamine abuse in those days, and he also bossed around Julius, who had been categorized by psychiatrists as a catatonic schizophrenic, and who would go months on end without uttering a syllable.
Yeah.
And so Peter was sort of gung-ho about the farm, but quite erratic, and would become loony at times, running across the hills, mooing like a mad cow.
Winter's coming on. Winter in upstate New York.
Yeah.
This must have presented some alarm. Is that too strong a word?
Well, there's some concern, and we took some steps to address that. We met some very young carpenters. We didn't realize how young they were, from Cooperstown, who were very eager to help us. But as they later said, their scheme was not very effective in terms of insulating. They thought they could save money on real insulation by putting in tongue and groove siding inside the walls, and it didn't work very well. And as I say, we had no electricity, so we had only a nice old wood and coal stove, the Kalamazoo, down in the kitchen, used for cooking and heating to keep us warm. But finally,
and I believe in the book you talk about winter, you could be warm if you stayed within, you know, 6 feet of
near the Kalamazoo, right?
Yeah.
But then we did finally get that first winter. We did get in time some propane gas put in, so that gave us little gas heaters in the rooms. But because there was no real insulation, the wind would sweep right through the rooms, and sometimes it was so strong it would blow the pilots on the gas heaters out.
Inside.
Yes.
Okay. You're here with a guy who is cranked on an amphetamines.
Yeah.
Catatonic schizophrenic.
Yeah.
Barbara and Candy and you, all from a city. And Allen Ginsberg,
yes.
When he's not traveling.
Right.
Can you talk about the interpersonal relationships?
Yeah, Peter was, in those days, I mean, I loved Peter and I was a friend, but in those days he was hostile towards everyone, including Alan, whom he greeted when Alan arrived by running towards him, brandishing a machete over his head.
Good golly. Okay, so how did you stay together in this house?
Well, separately. Peter had his way of doing things and would often clean the kitchen floor late at night, making loud sounds as he did with a bright Coleman lamp. He would, order Julius around. The rest of us would try and do various kinds of work. Peter would sometimes do very good work, but as I say, it was erratic.
Why did anybody put up with this guy?
Yeah, well, two reasons. One is out of love for Alan, because Peter came with Alan, and if you were going to be there, then that was something you accepted. But also Peter himself was such an original, totally American original, the most brilliant rooster that ever crowed. I said once, introducing him at a reading, he could see things that others didn't pick up on. He was uniquely expressive. As a Russian, he had this iron constitution and was heroic in his own way.
You essentially lived with Allen Ginsberg for several years. Mm-hmm. He was in and out traveling, but had a very close proximity to him and relationship with him. Can you talk about it?
Sure. Well, as I may have said earlier, he was saintly in that this whole farm was for the benefit of others. There was Peter, you know, I mean, you bought amphetamine in the city, not in upstate New York in those days. And likewise, Gregory Corso, a very fine poet friend of Allen's, was having trouble not only with alcohol, but with heroin. And Herbert Hunky, as he was sometimes called, Hunky the Junkie, would come up. And then we had big scenes because Hunky would always bring heroin and then deny that he had any. And then it would become apparent that he had. And Allen would blow up at him, but also was, you know, tolerant beyond measure as well, because he insisted that there be no needle drugs there. He went farther than almost anyone I've known for the sake of other people to try and address their needs.
I'm reading this and I'm saying, Ginsberg, you know, there's this firm rule about no needle drugs, which is constantly broken, and there's absolutely no consequences.
Well, he would get very angry with Hunky and tell him not to come back. And Hunky did end up staying away for a while.
Yeah, but then looking back on this now, do you ever think, my goodness, we were enabling those drug users?
Well, I mean, Allen came to see himself as an enabler, certainly in the case of Peter, and got help for that. But, I mean, it's a funny thing to say because he was so generous and so effectively generous in so many ways on behalf of others.
And provided this haven.
Yes.
What about sex? What was going on sex-wise?
You know, I have a friend who's writing a review for a magazine with a particular slant, and he said, I don't have time to read your book. Tell me where to go so I can quote the big sex scenes. Well, they're not big sex scenes. I mean, they're sex, but Allen and Peter had no real physical relationship at this point. And Peter, after my first year or so there, had a girlfriend who happened to come up and visit and settled in with us. Barbara left disillusioned with Allen, and Candy and I broke up. And so then I had girlfriends visiting, and there wasn't a whole lot shaking in sex. Julius was not sexually involved as a rule.
You are there. You're working physically very hard, sort of figuring out how to be a farmer. Mm. And as the seasons roll by, and you get pretty good at it.
Let me say that this is all on a very small scale. We had 70 acres of land. Some of it was wooded. Some of it was marshland. Some of it was sort of grassland, if you will. And goats would graze here and there. We had goats, too, once we were settled in, as well as cows and chickens and ducks. We had a main garden plot and then a second main plot, and totaling about an acre and a half or so. And we had the use of tractors every once in a while as needed, but otherwise it was all totally manual labor, and we were trying to raise everything organically. So farmer maybe is not quite the right word. We did have a few animals, including one or two horses and a cow and calves, and as time passed, they on the increase, but it never became a large affair, and it was plenty of work considering all the work that was needed as well around the barn and the house, as well as channeling water flows on the land and so forth. It was plenty of work for the two or three of us that would engage in it regularly.
How did the division of labor go?
Peter was very energetic, and it was a matter of focus. Peter and I would usually be up in the morning and milking or bringing the animals in at night and working in the garden during the day. Candy, when she was there, was quite vigorous. This was all during good weather. In bad weather, in the winter, which was almost 6 months out of the year, you would have 10 feet of snow in a winter. And half your day might be spent trying to get a car going or shoveling snow from the house to the barn, from the house to the first road that you could get to where the cars were parked, which would be at least 0.6 miles, or hoping that the snowplow would come and trying to get into town to get feed for the animals or groceries from the store.
You talked about being hopeful when you got there.
Yeah.
How was that hope doing in with 10 feet of snow out on the ground.
Well, it was a challenge, but it was interesting. And as I say, it was good work. You go to bed at night, you see the patterns of the things you've done. If it's you know, outside in the summer, all the vegetables that you're cultivating, you know, that your body's fatigued with good reason. And that's a good way of living.
You're there from age 23
yeah.
to 26?
Yeah, right? That sounds right. Yeah.
23 to 26.
Yeah.
What's your arc of change during those years because of this experience? What'd you learn?
Well, I would say to be more generous. I don't think I was a very charitable person when I arrived.
Really?
Yeah.
And how did that come about?
I think watching Alan's example. And also thoughtfulness and the powers of observation that he displayed.
Right. How did your adventure at the farm end?
Well, after a while, I felt that I wasn't needed anymore because Peter was sort of landing on his feet. He had a steady girl now. And she was helping him stay off amphetamine, more or less. That was working, and in that sense, the farm itself was working. And also, things were getting more complicated in terms of the war. Alan was worried about being scrutinized further by the government because of his protest activities against the Vietnam War, and the IRS had seized his bank account because he refused to pay money to the war. I think he wanted everything to be on a lower profile, and I wanted to get out and see more of the world.
Again, when I was reading this, I guess I expected it to be a hippy-dippy peace and love.
Mm.
It seemed hard.
Mm.
People seemed unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of friction. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which sounds like failure, but you're writing this book many years later, mm-hmm. and it's very important to you to tell this story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that?
Well, it was not a failure in that it helped Peter. I think it worked mm-hmm. for Peter. It didn't work for certain others. As Creeley said to Alan later, Robert Creeley, a very fine poet who would visit from time to time, they brought their problems with them about some others, like Gregory Corso, who would come and usually raise a ruckus. And he could be lots of fun, but there was always trouble when Gregory was there. And no, it never worked. He had no interest in the farm. And on his first visit, he went out to get something for his lunch from the garden. He just yanked the lettuce plants out of the earth, you know, in one big handful grab. No, it didn't work for some.
Gordon Ball's book is East Hill Farm, Seasons with Allen Ginsberg. You'll find some links relating to Gordon Ball's adventurous artistic life on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Well, I woke up this morning, looked at my door. Couldn't see my milk cow, can hear that mouthful loaded. See my milk cow, baby, drive around.